Okay, Rabotai, we're holding today, and you know what? We should actually start the dive, and then we went way ahead. Today's daf in Mesechet Ketuvot is daf Pei Dalet, and we're holding in the middle of this sugya in which Rav Paskin, like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, and namely, that the t'nai that he makes, we can call it a t'nai, it's more like a stipulation rather than an actual formal t'nai, because it's not really based on if this, then that, and so on, in which the person is mevater on his rights. So he waives his rights, and we had a whole discussion, how can you waive your rights? We talked about before he was actually a zocher, so she was there for an arusa. In any event, the reason that, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, it says, Beferish, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel gives his reasoning in the Mishnah, because you were matnao mashakatuv batorah. So in trying to be mevater, that is to say, to waive your rights to the Yerusha, you're actually trying to change a halacha that the Torah itself prescribed, and therefore it doesn't work. And the Baal will still get the Yerusha of his wife. Whereas Rav says, he's right in the sense of his psak, but he's wrong in his reasoning. And we examined all kinds of possible meanings to what Rav was saying. And we finally came out with understanding that what it was that Rav was saying was apparently that what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, namely that it's matnao mashakatuv batorah, is wrong. But the psak that he gave is right for another reason. It's matne al masha amru harabona, not al mashakatuv batorah, because Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel holds that the Yerushas isha by a husband is a diaraisa. And we learn it out from the extra words of the Arash Ota that appear inexplicably at the end of the story of Yerusha and the Torah, which talks about only Mishpacha, which is not a wife, who is not from the Mishpacha Ta'av. And therefore, he gave the reason that it's considered to be a Masa Mashakatuv Batorah. However, since, according to Rav, even though it's the Rabbanan, and he does not agree with Rav Shimon ben Gamliel that it's a diaraisa, but effectively it boils down to the same thing. Since, according to Rav, the Rabbanan were machmir on their dinim of Yerusha to be the equivalent of a diaraisa, so anyway it works out that a matna mashamru a Rabbanan would not be able to be mavato the Yerusha. And that's what Rav meant, which means that we came out yesterday with saying that, according to Rav, Yerushata Baal is only the Rabbanan, whereas Alibid Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Yerushat HaBaal is Dioraita. That's what the Gemara wants to examine today. Is it really true? Now, this is basically two lines down from the middle lines between the top of the page and the Mishnah. So therefore, the Gemara asks today, but is that so? That Rav actually holds V'Sovar Rav? And you're telling me that Rav holds that's the way you came out. The Yerushat HaBaal is only a Drabana. But I've got a problem with that from the Mishnah in Bechorot. It says over there, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Omer, someone who inherited his wife, when Yovel arrives, has to give back the property to the family. Yachzir livnei mishpacha. And when he gives it back, he deducts whatever it was that had been paid, yinakelehem min adamim, which is mashma, that it's sort of like taking it back at a discount because we discount the years that he used. It's very unclear what in the world this could mean, since when you return property in Yovel, obviously the whole idea is that there's nothing paid. So the whole thing makes no sense at all. Fine. So we asked over there in the Gemara itself, after that Mishnah in Bechorot. So the Gemara in Bechorot asked, what in the world is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka trying to say? I mean, if he holds that Yerushat HaBaal is a Dioraita, there's no din of giving back a Yerusha during Yovel. So the whole thing doesn't make any sense. What do you mean give it back? Amai Yachzir. And even if he holds that it's a Drabona, okay, so then what would that mean? That you return it in Yovel, because they only gave it a din that is the equivalent of a kinyan that you did business over. So then you should give it back without getting any money. I mean, when you bought something during the 50 years at any point, well, I shouldn't say any point that's not Kamina, the first 2 years of the year, but whatever. When you bought a property and Yovel was Chal and you have to give it back, well, you get money. You get money. So then why does it say over here he has to deduct the payment? What payment? They don't have to pay him anything. Now, Rav, so far this has nothing to do with our sugya, you see, but what Rav says in explanation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that has everything to do with our sugya, because Rav says over there something which contradicts completely what we just explained in our sugya about why Rav paskins like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, but specifically Lav Mitaime, namely that Rav holds that the Yerusha Sabal is a Darabanan. And over there, Rav says exactly the opposite. Listen to what Rav says. Ni'olam kaseva Yerusha Sabal d'oraita. Oh my gosh. So he says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka holds that no, it's a d'oraisa. So how is it that you have to give it back? What does that mean? It's talking about over here that when his wife died, he inherited the plot of the Beit HaKvarot of the family. Fine. So her father had purchased this plot and it was all there for members of the family. And when she died, he inherited it. And there we have a halacha, as we're going to see in a minute. We have a halacha that if somebody buys a burial plot off of a member of a family, the family can force him to sell it back. And there he has to be paid, obviously. That's what it's talking about. So in that event, if he inherited from her a family plot, that is called pigam mishpacha, for a family not to be able to be buried in their family plot. And instead, this guy is going to start burying his family in that plot. That's considered to be very insulting. It's simply a disgrace. And because of that, since it's a pigam is not stam, that it's hurtful. It's a true disgrace. You're saying something's wrong with the family. We didn't want to bury them there. And it looks terrible. And because of that, we force him to give it back. Well, Marabonan Lishko Dom, of course, you get money. I mean, he's not expected to beg. It's not his problem that it's the Pagam Mishpacha. So that much, he's going to have to be paid. But he is forced to sell, assuming that they pay him going market rates. So what did it mean when it said he has to deduct? That's a chat. Because since obviously for him to inherit his wife had to die, who is responsible for burying her? He is, right? So then that means if they buy back the burial plot, then they're paying him for the kever of his wife. No, that's his problem. So that has to be deducted, prorated, the number of graves that are there in the plot and so on. That is prorated, deducted one plot. He would have to pay for anyways. Of course, he can't charge him for that. So that's Mayinak Elemin Adamim. That's referring to the Mekever Ishto. And of course, I'll prove it to you, says Rav, that there is such a concept of forcing a person to sell back a plot of another family that he got. I don't care how he got it. And that is from a Braita, that if a person in a family was so desperate that he sold his kever plus the road to the kever that he owned, or the place that has been miyuchad, we had this a number of times, that the family also would be miyuchad, a place for the ma'amad and the hesped. The ma'amad is when they stop, and they, you know, nowadays the ma'amad is stopping at St. Kaddish, and some of those days they used to stop, and everybody would there was that whole girsa that you said, you know, shvu yikarim shvu and imdu yikarim imdu and so on. So that we don't do anymore, but that used to be a part, a very important part of the funeral. And every family, if they could afford it, had not only their own plot, but also their own ma'amad and their own hesped area, which today is a public thing. So there's a beit hesped for every beit hakvarot. And so, okay, but in that case where it belonged to the family, ba'in b'nei ha-mishpacha. So the other members of the family can come after this guy dies who sold it to someone else, and they can force, even though the guy says, hey, what are you doing? I paid money for that. Tough. And they're covering up to ba'al kocho. Of course, they have to pay him. But they can do that because it's a pigam to their family to have other people taking the graves that were meant and famously set aside for this family. And that's called a pigam mishpacha. Okay, that part is not important to us over here. What's important to us over here is that Rav openly states there that he agrees with Rav Shimon ben Gamliel with the logic of Reb Shimon ben Gamliel that a Yerushat HaBaal is a Dioraita. So why is he saying over here, no, but Reb Shimon ben Gamliel is wrong, because even though he's right in the Psak, but he's wrong in the reason for the Psak, because Yerushat HaBaal is not Dioraita, it's the Rabbanon, except that the Rabbanon were machmer in this issue to give it a din, similar to the Dioraita. Fine, that's lovely, but here he says, but Farish not like that. He says, actually, that it's Dioraita. Where did Rav say it's the Arisa, gentlemen? Rav was asked how to explain Reb Yochanan ben Broka in the Mishnah, right? So Rav explained Reb Yochanan ben Broka. What are you driving Rav crazy for? It's not his business what Reb Yochanan ben Broka holds, for God's sake. He's saying Reb Yochanan ben Broka holds that it's a Diaraita, and therefore you do not have to return it. And because of that, I need to explain that we're talking about the Kever Ishto and so on and so on. Where did he say that he agrees with it? He didn't say he agrees with it. Leilo Smirali, Rav himself does not agree. He holds that Be'etzim would only be a Drabonet. And that in that case, maybe they didn't give him a din of a Yoresh. Maybe he's only a Lokeach. If he's a Lokeach, he has to be Malzer and Yovo and so on. I'm not getting into that. I'm just explaining to you what the Shita of Reb Yochanan ben Broka is. And now that brings us to this famous moment in which Doc takes over. Long have we waited for this moment, and here we are, the first Mishnah of the new year, and we're zocha to hear it right from the very mouth of our beloved Doc. Go for it, Doc.
Zok the Helika Mishnah.
Beautiful. Okay, so now we've got all of these issues of what is considered to be the moment of the Baal, and the moment of the Isha, and the moment of the Yarshim. And we've gotten into some rather complex kind of problems over here when we can have conflicting claims to the same thing. And we had the Machlokas, Beit Shammai, and Beit Hillel in the previous parak, and what is the Halach of Nechsei Melug? Oh my God. And we also had a Mishnah that discussed over there what would be the din if the woman goes ahead and she's tofeset and she got these peirot that were lying there, and does she have a right to keep those? All kinds of questions of how much of a she'ibud, and in which cases, the death of an arusa, the death of an iswa, the death of a shomeret yavam, the death of a husband who's a yavam, the death of a husband who's an orus, the death of a husband who's an asuri. My gosh. Every element has to be determined in order for us to have a full grasp of the multiple levels and the complexity of the relationship, which extends, remember, even into the continuation of a marriage after death in the case of Yibum, where she is still considered to have that ksuva on her original marriage. Quite an amazing thing. Even in the event, remember, we discussed divorce and remarriage of the Yavama. This gives us an entirely different look, which, of course, is part of the whole question of Geula and the idea of Emer Dover B'Shem Emrei and all of the things that we learn about the amazing continued development of the earth, door, door, door after door. And we want the individual's shame that we spoke about on Erev Yontav. We need that the should be part of the Mekomo. It has to have its place. It has to be part of its family and be part of its door and to be traceable. And that's part of the nature of Geula itself. So these are quite amazing implications. And as usual, implications are the result of all kinds of silly, tiny questions that are very complex and intertwined. And in the same way that the most amazing ultimate effects come about in the world because of the most amazingly unknown for millennia processes that are going on hidden from the eye and that require all kinds of millions and millions of hours of research to understand that they even exist, the same thing is true in all of the minutiae, which goes into the determination of how these zechuyot work out in terms of the rites, lahalacha, and that ends up making immensely different implications for the nature of the infrastructure that underlies relationships in a real world in which money is, everybody knows, the bottom line, and that's the mishpatim, and that's the implications of the Torah and the Iker Bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, our determination of these things, although it strikes us as being, oh my God, there's so many factors, I'm not even getting to the bottom of this, This is exactly what we have to do. And therefore, the Mishnah continues now with more complex interaction. So let's imagine a situation where someone dies, and of course, his wife has a ksuba against him and against his property, but he's also got a mortgage, and the bank is after him, you know, and he also has heirs, and they're trying to assert their rights over his estate. And what happens? So he may have a picadon as well, in which case he had pawned something, you know, or he'd asked somebody to keep something for him. So his gold watch was in somebody else's rishus. Now his wife wants to collect that gold watch, but she can't because at the time of the Mishnah, remember, she has no right to metaltalim. So what we need to understand is, does she have rights if she's tofeset, which was a Mishnah we talked about before, what happens if she takes the peiros and so on? So in this case, he has a pikadon, or he's got money that he lent to others that is money coming into him, but is not yet in the rishus of his heirs. So remember that all of this question is based on a very important halacha, two very important halachas. First of all, she does not have the right to collect from metaltalim, bichlal. And in general, we have a klal, which Gavi is about to write, which is that the metaltali, the yasmi, lo mishtabde. So there is never any type of lien against metaltalim of the yetomim who inherited something. Liens are effective only against actual real estate. And therefore, in this case, we want to know what happens in the event that he's got various real estate, or even, as we're going to see, cases where he had things that were metaltalim, but still didn't belong to the Yorshim, which we have to figure out how is that possible. So here's the deal. Rabbi Tarfon says, look, what you should do is you should give the even though there's conflicting claims, you should give it to the one who has the weakest claim. So basically, we're going to see, the Gemara is going to ask what exactly, who is the weakest claim. But basically, the main issue here is that Rabbi Tarfon holds that even though the dinin are that the yorshim do not have any kind of shibudim against their metaltalim, in this case, there is a way in which we will give, as we're going to see, even things that otherwise would be called metaltalim or real estate. It's got to be given from, we take it out of the person who owes the money, and that's mechora metaltalim, or he owes the watch, which he's keeping, in the case of the pikadon, and it's going to be given either to the woman with her ksuva, or to the guy who is owed money for the mortgage, and that's because he was mitchayev while he was still alive, and somehow or other, Rabbi Tarfon says, we're able to get that. Rabbi Akiva says, what is that supposed to mean? The koshel shabam. What do you think we're dealing with over here? Romance? I don't understand. This is a court of law. It's not a bunch of poet. The dayanim are basically dayanim about dinim, and you're telling them to start reading poetry. What does koshel shabam have to do with a din? It's a good thing we didn't have this gemara yesterday. Ein merachamim bedin. Good Lord. So when it comes to a din, it's not about love. It's about, okay, what's the din? Don't give me love. You know, we can't allow that to influence our decisions in din. So therefore, says Rabbi Akiva, how can you take it away from the Yorshim? You give it to the Yorshim because obviously nobody else, and here we're talking about even if somebody was tofes, so let's say the Isha was tofeset or the mortgage holder was tofes, it wouldn't make any difference. Why? Because we do not recognize a claim until they take a shvua. Remember, you're never allowed to collect after the death of the individual who cannot defend himself in death. So after the death of the individual, the halacha is that in order to collect, you're going to have to swear that you were not paid in some way that we don't know about by the person who owed you money, one while you were alive. So even the woman has to swear, he didn't give me money in a safe deposit box, so I wouldn't have to go to court, remember? So, and certainly the creditor has to swear that he was never paid off early by an early payment on his mortgage or whatever. And therefore, until such time as that shvua is made, as far as we're concerned in this courtroom, there is no suit. So the instant of death, we did not have conflicting claims. You're saying we had conflicting claims. And let's think about who to give it to. There are no conflicting claims. There's one claim, and that is the Yorshim. The Yorshim are the only ones that get things without needing to swear, obviously. What do they have to swear about? The father died, it's their property. And therefore, it is ipso facto that belongs to the Yorshim by virtue of there being Yorshims. How do you take it away from them with a claim that didn't exist? Shekulam tzirchim shvua, ve'ena Yorshim tzirchim shvua. The same thing would be true now here. Is where we get into this issue of peirot that are, we had this discussion, it was very confusing to us before, peirot atrushim in akarka. So there were these peirot. Now, we don't know where these peirot are right now. Are these peirot on the field that the Yorshim inherited? So, I mean, then it's in their rishus. That the Gemara is going to be talking about. But if he left peirot, then whoever gets there first gets to keep those peirot. Now, it's going to be talking about, obviously, that it was not in the field that the Yorshim inherited, because then it would automatically be the Yorshim's. So it's got to be talking about it somewhere, let's say in a Rishus HaRabim, where everyone is the equivalent of anybody else. And because of that, whoever gets there first, even though there is no way to take it from the Yorshim because there's no Shibud on it, but if they go ahead and grab it before the Yorshim get it, so then it is considered to be Bidiyavad if they did it. How are the Yorshim going to get it away from them? So then it becomes theirs and not the Yorshim. Now the question, of course, is, but I thought according to Rabbi Akiva, there are no conflicting claims until the shvua is made. So that should mean that the tvisa is ridiculous. There is no tvisa. So why doesn't Rabbi Akiva argue? That the Gemara is going to be talking about in a moment. Now, in the event that they went ahead and were zaycha, but they overdid it. So the woman was owed 200 shekel, and she went ahead and when she was tofes at 300 shekel. What happens then? Or let's say the Baal Chov was owed 200 shekel. He went ahead and collected 300 shekel. So then anything above and beyond what it was that they have any rights to claim, that should be given back to whom? Says Rabbi Tarfon, the same deal. It should be given back to the one who has the weakest claim so that he should at least have an opportunity to collect, which otherwise he wouldn't have had. Whereas Rabbi Akiva says, what is this, a court of poetry or a court of law? In Merachamim Bedin, the only people that get it are the Yorshim, which makes no sense because according to Rabbi Akiva, why are we talking about the motar, the extra, not the extra? According to Rabbi Akiva, the whole thing shouldn't have been taken because according to Rabbi Akiva, we don't have conflicting claims. We have only one issue that belongs to the Yorshim because everybody else needs a shvua. So why is Rabbi Akiva talking about the motar? That the Gemara is going to ask. And here he gives the same reason. Kulam tzrichim shvua, but the Yorshim don't need a shvua. Now, of course, the Mishnah repeats itself over here. It talks about two different cases. It talks about a milva and it talks about a pikadon. I mean, do I really need to have two cases that are the same? Of course, says the Gemara. What's the matter with you? They're totally different. Tzricha, let's say the Tana would only say a case of a milva. So I would say, well, you know why Rabbi Tarfon says that the Yorshim are not kind of the milva immediately the way Rabbi Akiva said? Because the milva doesn't exist. The milva is owed, but it's not there. When somebody makes a loan, the money that was given in the loan is meant to be spent. It's not meant to be put into a jar and to be kept until the guy wants it back, obviously. So since a note, Gavi, please. Milva lo hotza'a nitna. Okay, so that's the yesod here. Milva lo hotza'a nitna. So since a milva, by definition, is given for purposes of expenditure, And therefore, it doesn't exist. Even if the guy kept the money in a jar and hasn't used it yet, it's still, that's his money. It's not the other guy's money. We never expect you to pay back a milvah with the money that was given to you. And therefore, I would say, yes, Rabbi Tarfon says, what do you mean? The Yorshim. The Yorshim, there's nothing here for the Yorshim to get. It's a chiv to be given, but it's, they don't have a physical object to get. So that may be the reason that Rabbi Tarfon said that we don't give it to the Yorshim, but maybe a pikadon where somebody is holding the deceased gold watch. So over there, the watch exists, the ite be'ine. So since the pikadon is ite be'idne, so because of that, maybe it would be made to Rabbi Akiva that the Yorshim immediately collect that gold watch because it is extant. And of course, in that case, maybe he would agree with Rabbi Akiva. Marshainkin, if the Tana had said only the case of this, where there's a gold watch, I would say, well, of course, Rabbi Akiva said in that case, but only in that case, that the Yorshim are able to collect it because it exists. And therefore, instantly, it goes into their rishus because they don't need any shvua. And there are no conflicting claims until the other people take a shvua in court. Alvo Bahach, Hema Modal, Rabbi Tarfon. Maybe even Rabbi Akiva would agree that if it's only a loan that is due, but it doesn't actually exist as a physical object, so then maybe he would agree that everybody's in the same kind of problem. We have conflicting claims. Therefore, tzricha, we need to know that Rabbi Akiva talks about all cases, even cases in which you would think that there is actually a basis for us to say, like Rabbi Tarfon. Okay, now can I understand what you mean when you say Rabbi Tarfon says, give it to the weakest? I mean, that really sounds crazy. What do you mean to the weakest? So we have two approaches to this. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina says, give it to the person who has the least ability to otherwise collect. Because I'll tell you, remember that these people hold, the woman holds her ksuva, it's dated. The person who made the loan, so over there, he also has a dated contract. Now, the earlier contract is going to have a she'ibud against more real estate, right? Because you always are going to have to prove that this real estate was sold to a third party, which you want to collect from, after the debt to you or the marriage to you already incurred that debt, right? So that would mean that the person who has the latest dated contract is in the worst position, because we'll never give it to him if he can't prove that he's got the earlier she'ibud. So therefore, what we do is we give the person, we said that if we're talking about over here, if we have available, finally, some alternative to the real estate, and this guy can't claim against the real estate because the real estate has been sold and his contract cannot be shown to be early enough to predate the sale. So if we have these metaltalin, and that's what we're saying, we have either the moser, the tviser, we have the metaltalin that exists not as part of the yorshim's rishus because it was in somebody else's rishus, or it was a debt that was coming in and hadn't been collected yet. So be a good guy. For God's sake, the other people over here have a contract. They're going to be able to go after this property, even though it was sold 20 years ago. And he or she, depending who has the earlier date, the later date, is not going to be able to go after the real estate. So if there's an opportunity to give that person who's at a real disadvantage in terms of the collection, to give them the gold watch, or to give them the money that was coming in for the due debt, so it's only right to give it to them because they're the ones who are otherwise not going to be paid. So it makes sense. Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the one that needs it the most is the ktuvat isha. It's given to her because, and that's even if she has an earlier shtar, and she's in a good position to be able to go into court and to claim that she wants the property that had been sold many years before, but subsequent to her own marriage. And therefore, her she'ibud came before the sale of the property. So you'll say, well, she doesn't need my help. I mean, why in the world should I give her Doc's gold watch? I mean, for heaven's sakes, it's a, she can collect directly from the property, right? But the idea over here is that a woman is always in a weak situation. Why is that? Because, as we said, it's not the derech of a woman to go around and try to file suits in court and go after people and so on. It just runs against the way she likes to act. And therefore, she's considered to be a koshel for whom it's very difficult to get this kind of collection done. She's going to go to court and expose herself and talk about it. It's not for her. So give it to her. And that way there will be china. Now, what does china mean? It doesn't mean what we do today before a wedding, but it does sort of relate to it, because china, according to Rashi, means that we want women, in this case, I mean, generally china is this, that we want women to feel good about getting married. And you can certainly understand why they wouldn't. So in order to make it easier for them to break through the psychological barriers to marriage, which include the worry of, oh, I'm going to give my life to this jerk and then he's going to up and die or something, and what am I going to have? So in order to make marriage more palatable, so we therefore make it easier for her to collect her ksuva. So people will see, you see, this woman went ahead and nobody else was able to take Doc's watch and so on, and she's the only one who got it. So that will make her feel, other women, obviously, when they see this, you know, oh my, I had a niece who was married and she was able to get her ksuva, even though the guy didn't leave her any, she didn't have to go to court. I mean, great, okay, so then that teaches another niece somewhere else that she can also go and get married and not have to risk. That's the way Rashi learns, which is the standard type of china. Rabbeinu Hanano learns that it means the chain of the woman, meaning that we want women whose husband died to be able to have money instantly so that they would be a good catch for a new husband. So we want the women to have chen in men's eyes by being rich. Okay, but whatever, but that's the idea over here, to the idea of a koshel. And this is basically a machlokes tanoi. Rabbi Binyamin Omer, this is a bright, says Rabbi Binyamin Omer, when we say the koshel, we mean the one who has the weakest raya, the koshel shebaraya, and that's right to do. V'hu kasher. It's just right to do the right thing, because you're not hurting anybody else. They have claims that they can follow, and she is going to be, or he, in the event that he has a later contract, is not going to be able to claim it unless he gets the watch. And therefore, that's what you ought to do. Whereas Rabbi Elazar says, no, we're more concerned about chinah, and therefore give it to the ketuvah tisha. Okay, then we talked about the case of a tfisa, where there were peres that were lying on the ground, and there the question is that the guy who had the chov, he collected, and she collected her ksuva, and now they over-collected, and money's got to be refunded, and who gets the refund? Now, Rabbi Akiva says the refund goes to the right person, which is the yarshin, not to the koshel. Why is Rabbi Akiva talking about refunds? According to Rabbi Akiva, it's not the refund. It's the whole darn thing that's supposed to be given back. So why does he talk to Rabbi Tarfon as if, yes, Rabbi Tarfon, we do have to deal with the refund, but the refund should not be given to the koshel? That's not the point. There's no refund. All of it goes to the Orshim, no? Yeah, of course. Enoch Inami, obviously, Rabbi Akiva doesn't mean personally that he holds as a refund. He's responding to Rabbi Tarfon. So Rabbi Tarfon says, what do you do with the motar? So Rabbi Akiva says, will you stop giving me your lovey-dovey stuff in a courtroom? There is no lovey-dovey stuff in a din. And this is why it is that the Rebbe didn't show up on Rosh Hashanah. He didn't want to hear anything about Rabbi Akiva saying, ein merachem in the din. That was the whole point of Rosh Hashanah to the Rebbe. And therefore, it's good that he came, but you came a little bit too early, Rebbe. You're still going to hear Rabbi Akiva's fateful words. Ein merachem in bedin. So therefore, I'm talking to you on your own level, Rabbi Tarfon. You all, there's a Moser, fine, the Moser, but in reality, he doesn't get anything. Wait, are you saying, according to Rabbi Akiva, what? There's no way to be Tofes ever, and the Yarshim will always inherit even the Metaltalin, and you can never come with a claim by saying that you were Tofes? Is that true? Omer Rava, Omer Nachman, no. It's not true. It's that if you were toe-faced while the guy was alive, that's something else. he owed you money. You were tofes during his lifetime. So over there, even after the guy's death, you can actually be tofes. That's true. But not if you're tofes afterwards. And according to Rabbi Tarfon, who says you can even after the husband died, you could still be tofes. Explain to me, where are these peirot right now? Because, I mean, if they're in the field that was left to the Yorshim, so then they were already tofes, so to speak, because a person's property is kona for him, right? So then that means that they already own it. So where exactly are these peirot right now? Rav and Shmuel agree that they are piled in up in Rishus HaRabim somewhere, and therefore the Yorshim don't have any more kinyonim than anybody else does. But if they were in a simta, then even though it's not owned by them, Rabbi Tarfon is wrong, and you cannot, or he didn't say it, because if it's in a place where it's possible for the Yorshim to be koneh, then the Yerusha is kona for them, even if their property isn't kona for them. Now, the din is, every Rishus HaRabim has got what is called a simta, or it's the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim that we spoke about. And that's because, as Rashi explains, you can't hear yourself talk in a Rishus HaRabim. And therefore, if anybody is conducting serious business, what they say is, let's sit down over here in the cafe on the street, which is on the sidewalk, basically, and we'll conduct our business. So over there in a simta, you have a place where business is conductable and kinyanim can be made, but it doesn't belong to the Yorshim, obviously. It belongs to everybody, but it's possible for you to be Canaan. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish disagree with Rav and Shmuel. So we have interesting case where Rav and Shmuel both agree against Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who also both agree, but in the opposite direction. And they say, even if it's in a simta, there is no kinyan if there is a situation of multiple claims. So it's not the equivalent of being in your own rishos, and therefore it's not true that he would agree with Rabbi Akiva in this case. And there was actually a maisa where some dayanim issued a psak, like Rabbi Tarfon, and they allowed a balchov to keep peros that he had collected. And Reish Lakish actually was empowered. Remember, he was the one that had the rishus of the government and so on. And he was ahadir Reish Lakish uvda minayo. He reversed the court's decision. And he gave it back to the Yorsh. So in other words, he paskin like Rabbi Akiva against them. Omar le Rabbi Yochanan, I understand you're making Rabbi Akiva the equivalent of Halacha L'Mesh Misinai. I mean, I understand that. Why are you saying that it's like a ta'ut bidvar mishnah, that the whole thing, the court's ruling is batal and mevutal? I mean, because they didn't agree with Rabbi Akiva, is it like it's like a d'oraisa? Asita Keshel Torah, I mean, it's one opinion. And that's not called To'e Bidvar Mishnah, that you're able to be Maxir the whole thing, is it? So perhaps Gufa, that's the Machlokas. So Lema Balkam, if again, maybe Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan are disagreeing about the very fact of what the din is, but din of a To'e Bidvar Mishnah. The Mar Sava To'e Bidvar Mishnah Choser, Umar Sava To'e Bidvar Mishnah Eno Choser. So could it be that Gufa is the question of Reish Lakish, who actually canceled the whole thing? He says, well, it's a Dvar Mishnah. Now, remember that what is called a Dvar Mishnah is a developing idea, right? Because, I mean, nowadays, let's say that a Dayan is and he issues a Psak that is Keneged all of the major Peskim, right? Now, I mean, he can tell him that he disagrees with those Peskim and Mukhiyev to accept. It's not as if it's a deraisa or anything. But nonetheless, we consider that to be Torah Bidvar Mishnah. Now, in the time of the Gemara, a psak that was issued by Rabbi Akiva was also called a Torah Bidvar Mishnah. It's not a deraisa. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan is saying, well, I don't understand what you're making it into a deraisa, that the guy made such a mistake and that you're canceling the judgment. But maybe that's good for the point. What might be over here is that Rabbi Yochanan says that even though it was a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. In other words, we should have paskin like Rabbi Akiva, but if you didn't, you didn't. It's not called a Torah N'Diraisa, because maybe Rabbi Yochanan Gufa holds it a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. We don't cancel the judgment. And that Gufa would be the machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yishmael. No. Everybody agrees that Torah B'dvar Mishnah, we are mevatel the judgment. The question is this case a Torah B'dvar Mishnah? The only reason we're considering it to be a Torah B'dvar Mishnah is because, remember, we have a klal in how to paskin. And one of those klalim refer to Rabbi Akiva. Halacha ku Rabbi Akiva michaveiro velo michaveirav. Right? Now, in this case, it's not a machlokas michaveirav. There's only one person who's arguing on him, and that's Rabbi Tarfon. The problem is that Rabbi Tarfon was Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe. So there the question might be that does the klal that we paskin like Rabbi Akiva in the psak, does it apply even against his own Rebbe? That's the question. And maybe that's the machlokas. Rabbi Yochanan holds that kalochak Rabbi Akiva mechaveiro, but not against his own Rebbe. And since Rabbi Tarfon was his Rebbe, so Rabbi Yochanan was scandalized. Why is Reish Lakish canceling a din where it's not part of the general ruling that we paskin like Rabbi Akiva against Rabbi Tarfon, is it? Because Rabbi Tarfon was a Rav. Mashenken Reish Lakish says, look, it doesn't say anything about that. The klal of the Psak Halacha is paskin like Rabbi Akiva if there's only one individual that's arguing against me. The only record we have of the Machlokas over is Rabbi Tarfon against Rabbi Akiva. So therefore, I'll leave it to Reish Lakish. This was a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. I'll leave it to Rabbi Yochanan. It was not a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. I could say another shot. Maybe the question is whether Rabbi Tarfon is considered to be Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe at this point. Or once Rabbi Akiva became so great, he's considered to be like a chaver. That's the question. So maybe everybody agrees that, of course, we wouldn't paskin like Rabbi Akiva even against his rabbo. It may be true. I look at Rabbi Akiva, and the word chaveiro does not mean against one person. It means literally his friend, but not his Rebbe, who's not called his friend. But the question is Rabbi Tarfon called a friend? Is Rabbi Tarfon called a rabbo? So Mar Sav Rabbi Yochanan holds that Rabbi Tarfon maintains his standing as Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe even now. And Mar Sav Reish Lakish holds that at this point that we consider Rabbi Tarfon to basically be a friend because he was a Talmud Chover. And that's the question. A Talmud Chover, does he have a din? It's true that you may have learned from him, but in terms of your godless, it's the same level of godless. It's not considered to be rabbo. Or I can give him another explanation. I can tell you, everybody agrees that he had a din of a chaver. So what are they disagreeing? So Mar Savar Halacha Itmar. Reish Lakish holds that the klal of paskin like Rabbi Akiva is, quote, Halacha k'Rabbi Akiva michaveiro. Pashenshkein Rabbi Yochanan did not have that nusach at all in his klale halacha. It was Matine k'Rabbi Akiva, we lean to Rabbi Akiva's opinion, but it doesn't mean it's an absolute halacha. And because of that, why are we going to reverse a court decision? It's not considered to be a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. It just said to lean. Maybe we did lean. Now, there was an actual maisa where one of poor Rabbi Yochanan always gets caught up in these situations where his relative comes to court, you know, and then he starts kicking himself for being a bad boy and giving good answers to his relative. Anyway, in this case, he was okay. So a relative of Rabbi Akiva had grabbed a para from Yatomim. So this relative was owed money, did not have any way to collect from real estate, but there was the cow that was wandering around a simta when the guy who owed him the money died, and this relative was really fast, jumped in, he's dead? Ha ha! He goes and he grabs the para. So, okay, so now the heirs came to Rabbi Yochanan to ask, so what's the deal? So Rabbi Yochanan said to his krovim, very good, chop it to fastua. You got it just in time, which is, you know, you got it because of tvisa. Which is a little bit of a problem because we just said that Rabbi Yochanan holds like Rabbi Akiva. He just holds you don't reverse a decision. Well, why was he telling them you did the right thing? According to Rabbi Akiva, you're actually not supposed to paskin like the person who holds like Rabbi Tarfon, right? So how exactly did he say you did the right thing? All right, so it's a question. Some taina that they must have gone to another Bezdin that paskin, and then they told the story to Rabbi Yochanan. He said, okay, so if that's the case, we don't reverse it. So you did the right thing. You saved yourself, you know, maybe. There's a lot of discussion about this. Anyway, so then they went to Reish Lakish. And Reish Lakish said, you better give back that cow. Because I don't care, according to this approach, I don't care if they paskin like you. Remember that it's the equivalent of a Torah B'dvar Mishnah. So they came to Rabbi Yochanan and they said, Reish Lakish says we can't keep it. What do we do? What can I do? Said Rabbi Yochanan. Remember, Reish Lakish is as good as I am. And Shekinegdi Chalukalai, I've got a guy that knows as much as me and he disagrees. I can't fight Reish Lakish. Ahu Bakra the Yat. I mean, there was a guy who was the Bakar. The Bakar is the equivalent of a Ro'eh for Tzon. The Bakar is for Bakar. Okay, so he's like the cowboy for these guys. And what happened is that someone who was owed money by their father grabs one of the Bakar. He grabs an ox from him. And then the Balchov, who was the one who grabbed it, he says, well, I grabbed it while he was still living. And remember that Tvisa during the guy's life is a good Tvisa, even a little bit of the Akiva, because there it is, Meshubah. Once he takes it, now the guys are going to be able to remove it from him. Well, I did this before the guy died. I heard he was sick and he was in the hospital. I ran and I grabbed it before he died so I wouldn't get into the argument with Rabbi Akiva. Whereas the cowboy said, no, he actually got it after the father had died. Anyway, so they come to Rabbi Nachman, and Rabbi Nachman says to the cowboy, Itlcha Sahadeh de Tafse. So do you have any witnesses, Bichlal? I mean, this guy admits that he took the ox from the herd, you know, but suppose he hadn't admitted it. I mean, do you have independent corroboration of the fact that this guy stole it, basically? He walked in there and he took it away from your herd? And he said, no, I mean, it's just a fact. I don't have witnesses. So then Rabbi Nachman said, well, the guy could have denied stealing it. The guy could have denied being tofes it. I mean, he happened to be a good man, and he said, yes, it's true. I did take it from out under the hand of the cowboy, but he could have said, I bought it directly from the man. You wouldn't have been able to disprove it because you're admitting you don't have any kind of witnesses. So then the guy has a wonderful migo. I mean, he's the one that said he was tofes it. So migo, diachol ha-memer lakuachu biyadi, he could have said, what do you mean? This is my ox. What are you talking about? I wasn't tough as this ox. I bought this ox years before. It's all mine. I thought he could have said to you. So because of that, it's amigo to say, Yochanan Lamema, it's true. I was tough as it, but mechayim tafisnale. So in this case, if we would have had an aid fight, so then enochinami, there would be a problem if he took it against the chazaka. But in this case, he has a wonderful actual migo. Really? I thought Reish Lakish says that godrot elam chazaka, anything that moves around. Now, animals will wander from place to place, right? So anything that's kept in a gut there, anything that has to be kept penned in, because otherwise it wanders. Let's say you never know where a rebbe may end up. He could be in Italy one day. He could be in Rehavia the next day. It's mind-boggling. So this is called godrot. So now the question is, do you have a chazaka that he's going to show up to Daf Yomi or not? Certainly don't have a chazaka because he moves around from place to place. So the same thing would be true. In this case, we've got these cows that are wandering around. And because of that, you cannot use the fact that you are in possession of something to claim that it's yours. So what are you telling me? That since he could have claimed that he bought this ox, so because of this, we would actually have to believe him when he says that he was tefes, but he was tefes after the person's death. And that's different. You're right about that in general, but not when we're talking about an ox. An ox is very valuable, And therefore, it's not like all of those cows that Gavi meets every morning in his walks. Well, who knows who owns those cows? Those are Godrot. But an ox, you're usually very careful with. And that's given to a cowboy to take care of. You can't let an ox wander around. And that's Mesira L'Ro'eh. That we will give over to some cowboy to keep it. And therefore, something that big is not considered to be Godrot. So if somebody has it, so then it must be that he has a right to have it. There's actually a big machlokas whether we mean this in general, and that you never have a problem with the chazak on an ox, or in this case, it happens to be. The fact is that it was in the rishus of this cowboy, and because of that, it certainly is not considered to be godrot. That's a machlokas. Now, there was another maisa, which had to do with the family of the nus. So over there, they had a loan against somebody, and the guy died, and they grabbed a maid who was in a simta. So it was basically not in the rishus of the atomim when the guy died. And they took away the maid from the atomim. So Rabbi Abu, Rabbi Chanina Rabbi Papi, and Rabbi Yitzchak Mafcha, they were the bezdin. And they had a bezdin, but Rabbi Abba was sitting in front of the bezdin. He wanted to hear how they would judge it. And they bring this case. And the three dayanim that we just mentioned, they say to the lawyers of the Nasim, they say, yeah, you have a right to keep the maid. Shapir tefastio. So Rabbi Abu is outraged, and he gets up and he says to the Dayanim, he says, look at you guys, just because you're nervous about the Beis HaNasi, so because of that, you're going to go and you'll be machniv to them, and you paskin like that you had a right to. And I'll tell you a story where some guys did the same thing you did, and Rabbi Shlokish came along and smacked them in the face by reversing the din. And that's basically what you're doing. You're supposed to pass him like Rabbi Akiva. And according to Rabbi Akiva, it never helps. So how come you have the chutzpah? You have to give it back. Rabbi Shlokish, he reversed their din, and he would certainly reverse your din. And another meiser was once where Yemar Bar Chasho, Rabbi Masik Bezuzi Behu Gavra, this gentleman, Yemar Bar Chasho, had a good claim against a guy who died, Shachiv, and he left a boat. So this was of course, a Russian oligarch. So all they had to go after was the yacht. Now, the question is, what is the din of the yacht? So he goes ahead, and he says to someone, go and be toe-faced that yacht for me. The U.S. gets away with murder. Why can't I? So he goes and he's toe-faced the yacht. Fine. So now Pogo by Rav Papa, Rav Huna, brother of Yoshua. So he bumps into this guy who was on his way to grab the yacht. Omar Le, at toe-faced the Balchol, the Mokum Shechav La'acherim. Excuse me. By doing that, you are an invalid shliach. You were sent by somebody to do something. But what it is that you're doing is turning the tables against many other people who have claims against this yacht. And therefore, when you go ahead and you do something on behalf of someone else where it causes a loss to other people, that then is lo kana, and that the person who sent you to get it, he does not get a kinyan, and therefore all of you are in the same boat. And therefore, what happened was that, fine, what they did, this is a classic, what they did, Rav Papa and Rav Huna, brother of Yeshua, what they did after dissuading this guy from going ahead and grabbing the boat, they went and grabbed it themselves because they were also owed money by this boat. And by making themselves all in the same boat, they drove away with the boat. How do you like that? So tafsu inu. Now, what happened was that the question was they couldn't get the engine started. What do they know about oligarch yachts, you know? So Rav Papa, he decided he's going to row, row, row the boat. So he jumps onto this yacht and he rows away with the boat. Whereas Rav Huna, Breda Rav Yoshua, said, you can't row away a yacht. I'm going to be Moshech the yacht. So what he does is he grabs the ropes that the yacht had been tied up with, and he pulls on it to do it with Mashiach. Now they're fighting against each other. Rav Papa against Rav Huna, Bereder of Yeshua. Who was Kone the boat? The rower or the puller. So Mar Omer Ana Kanina Leilakula, Umar Omer Ana Kanina Leilakula. So now Reb Pinchas Barami meets up with them and he says to them, didn't Rav and Shmuel both say that you're only able to grab something from Yesonim if it's not in the Rishus of the Yesonim? It has to be in a Rishus Harabim. And over here, if it were not in a Rishus Harabim, they paskin that even if it was in a Simta, which this is, so this is a dock, basically it's docked up against the side of the dock, and that gives it a din of a simta. But according to Rav and Shmuel, they both held that even if it's in a simta, Rabbi Tarfon is made to Rabbi Akiva that you cannot be tofes. And therefore, even though that goes against Rabbi Yochanan Resh Lakish, but it is Rav and Shmuel, so none of you got the right to actually grab the yacht. So they say to him, they say back to him, amen. So this already is a little bit of a question of the Girsa. Let's read the Girsa as we have it here. So we can say Omrule. They all both said to him, Ananami, Mecharifuta Denara Tafizo. It's not true. We did not grab it from the dock. What we did is we grabbed it from the middle of the current. And it was absolutely the equivalent of Rishus HaRabim, and it needed a lot of rowing. I can tell you, listen, take a look at my muscles. You'll see how much rowing I did. Took a lot of pulling. Look at my muscles. It'll show you how many pullings I did. And this is basically where they were tining that they are neither me or you is the one who gets the boat. So finally, the case came to Rava, which is by now it's quite complicated. Everybody's got conflicting claims and they're all in the same boat, says Rava. You know, you guys with your white hair and you think you're big rabbis, you know what you look like to me? You look like white geese. So you're kaki chivre, you're these white geese with all your white hair, you know. And what you do is you go around stripping people of their clothes. What kind of business is this? Running around stealing things from people. Hachi Omer Reb Nachman, the din of a tfisa is only, we paskin, if the guy was still alive, because that's how Rabbi Akiva paskin. You cannot be tofes at all. And therefore, this entire thing is ridiculous, because all of you were tofes, not only but Rabbi Akiva, and as we just saw, Reish Lakish actually was reverse the psak of anybody who paskin against Rabbi Akiva and so on, and therefore stop going around tearing off people's clothing and give it back.